Today on Against the Grain, blockbuster drugs are launched by the pharmaceuticals industry to great fanfare, and often with a stratospheric price tag. Yet despite the hype and cost, many of those drugs turn out to be less than useless. How is it that so many drugs that are vetted by the Food and Drug Administration escape real scrutiny? Jerry Avorn, one of the most cited scientists in medicine, discusses the deeply compromised state of drug production and government regulation in thrall to a for-profit system. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Americans pay twice the price for drugs than residents of other advanced industrial countries, while much of the research is funded by U.S. taxpayers. And many of these drugs turn out to be ineffective and even harmful. How is that, when the government, through the FDA, is charged with regulating medicines? To answer that question, I'm joined by Jerry Avorn, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. His research group showed that the painkiller Vioxx, then one of the world's most prescribed drugs, increased the risk of stroke and heart attack. Merck eventually withdrew the drug from the market after making billions of dollars from it. Avorn's latest book is Rethinking Medications, Truth, Power, and the Drugs You Take, which is published by Simon & Schuster. And we're talking at a time when the Trump administration has taken aim at scientific research and Harvard in particular. Jerry, I wonder if we could begin with this. At what point did the U.S. start regulating medicines, and what came before that?
Well, what came before that was chaos, and we began regulating medicines in little baby steps beginning in 1906. And they were very modest steps, but together over a century or more, they added up to some very important things. So the first was, and it was met with a lot of resistance by people who said that it was infringing on people's liberty. But all it was require manufacturers to say what was in the bottle that they were selling of pills or liquid or whatever. And the reason that was important was because back in 1906, there were a lot of medicines that were sold over the counter. We didn't even have the concept of a prescription drug, certainly not of a controlled substance back in 1906. And so manufacturers were making elixirs of various kinds that would contain opium or alcohol or cocaine. And nobody quite knew what they were taking. It just made them feel better or more relaxed, you know. And the problem, of course, is that if you keep taking opium to feel relaxed, it's got obvious consequences. And so in the progressive era in 1906, back when we had progressive eras, somebody said, just make the manufacturers say what's in the bottle or in the pills. That's all. They don't have to do anything else. And there was a huge backlash by the then tiny pharmaceutical industry, but it did pass Congress, and that was the beginning of what was then called the Pure Food and Drug Act, which was really embedded in the whole progressive era of the beginning of the 20th century, that, you know, the government should inspect meat to make sure that it's not full of vermin and, you know, other things that were the very beginnings of trying to regulate things in the interest of people so they didn't get sick from what they bought. So that was 1906, baby step, but useful. But there was no requirement that anything needed to actually not be poisonous or have to work. That was a bridge too far back in those days. And as I mentioned in the book, in 1938, there was a catastrophe in which many, many children across the country died because there was an antimicrobial, one of the early ones called sulfanilamide. And a manufacturer decided that it would be good to dissolve it in a new solvent they hadn't used before, because it would taste better and it would go down easier and kids would like it. It turned out that that solvent was what we now refer to as antifreeze, and it was toxic. And that caused a lot of deaths because there was never a requirement to show your drug isn't poisonous. And so in 1938, we had the first real reform of the Pure Food and Drug Act, and the then FDA said, well, maybe your medicine shouldn't be poisonous. And there was a lot of pushback and saying, oh, no, who are you to tell consumers what they can buy? But that passed, and there was a new requirement that manufacturers had to show that their drugs wouldn't kill people. But still, in 1938, nothing about does it need to work. And fast forward to 1962, where Senator Kefauver, who is a progressive Democrat, said, you know, maybe the FDA should require manufacturers to show that their drugs actually are effective before the FDA will approve them. And that was met with an incredible hue and cry about how dare you, and this is government overreach, and let Americans have the freedom to take whatever they want without having the government meddle in those decisions, and you're limiting the freedom of doctors. And it was about to go down in flames in Congress. And then there was this thing that many listeners will know about, which was the thalidomide disaster. And for those who haven't heard of it, that was a drug that was widely used in Europe, Japan, Australia, all over the world except the U.S., that was a sedative and an anti-nauseant. And it was particularly heavily promoted by its manufacturer for pregnancy, because they said this is just the right thing for pregnant women who have morning sickness. And they then applied to have it marketed in the U.S. And back in 1962, there was a young woman named Frances Kelsey, it was her first job out of her medical training. And she said, okay, show me the evidence that it's safe and we'll approve it for use. And the manufacturer had her get a lot of testimonials of women who took it and said, this really helped my morning sickness, or it helped me fall asleep at night. And she said, well, that's nice, but that's not evidence, that's testimonials. And then the companies began to complain, who is this pointy-headed FDA bureaucrat that is slowing down access of Americans to this wonderful drug? And they went to their congresspeople, and it looked like she was going to be proven wrong and overruled, which still happens at FDA for good, hard-working scientists at FDA whose bosses want to approve drugs. And then when it became clear that the drug actually was causing horrible birth defects in all around the world, except the U.S., because good old Dr. Kelsey had said she wanted to see some safety data before she would approve it. And that propelled Senator Kefauver's progressive legislation across the finish line. And that gave the FDA, for the first time, the ability to require that a drug maker had to show that their drugs were effective, as well as not being poisonous, before it could be approved. And so that sort of a long way around to say that was one of the most important developments that we saw, that the world had seen, in the idea that government can serve a very useful function, making sure that drugs actually work before they can be sold as prescription drugs.
And without romanticizing it, that period from the 60s to the 70s, you referred to as a kind of golden age of the regulatory system for drug approval in the U.S., I wonder if you could tell us how regulation shifted, ironically enough, in response to the AIDS epidemic, which so many activists at the time felt outraged that a right-wing government in power was doing way too little to try and approve drugs for HIV/AIDS, given its association with gay people and the homophobia of the Reagan administration. Can you tell us how that was a strange and yet shifting moment for the way the FDA operated?
Yeah, and I think that's a very good way to put it, that it seemed, you know, to all and all of us who lived through that era, that it was plausible for AIDS activists, and there are also some cancer patient activist groups as well, to say circa 1989-90, we're in the middle of a lethal epidemic. We don't have any drugs that are able to save our lives and those lives of our friends and community. Why is FDA taking so long to do all these tests? Why can't you just say, here's a drug that looks promising, we'll approve it, and then we will complete the testing. But if that takes another year, if it turns out to work, then maybe we'll have made it available to people and it might save their lives. And that was a reform that many people welcomed. It made a lot of sense. And so in 1992, at the height of the AIDS epidemic, the FDA came up with this new concept, which seemed utterly sensible at the time, called accelerated approval. And it was kind of a social contract with the manufacturers of drugs. That is, FDA said, we will approve your drug based on it's kind of looking promising without your having to show that it actually yet benefits patients. But if you can show that it makes a lab test look a little better, or in the case of AIDS, viral load, or some other measure that's not actually evidence that it's curing or even ameliorating disease, but it makes the lab test better, we'll let you market it, and then we'll require that you're part of the bargain, Mr. Drug Company, and it was Mr., of course, in those days, still mostly is, need to go ahead and do the testing that's required to show that that promising-looking change in a lab test is actually a marker for the drug helping patients. And so many people applauded that, and it was the birth of the concept of accelerated approval. The problem is that if you fast forward to current times, the drug manufacturers have figured out a way of really abusing that process by taking a number of drugs, and I refer to a bunch of them in the book. Drugs for muscular dystrophy are a particularly important example, where they will show a tiny change in a lab test and say, okay, this is a surrogate measure and maybe it'll benefit patients, give us accelerated approval. And then the FDA said, you got to go ahead and do those follow-up tests like the law says, right? And the company said, yeah, sure, okay, whatever. And then actually did not end up doing the follow-up tests. And we ended up, in the case of muscular dystrophy drugs, with a lot of drugs that actually do not work, but were kind of allowed into the marketplace. And of course, they charge full price for the drugs. And sometimes that's hundreds of thousands of dollars per patient per year on the basis of this accelerated approval process, which was that well-intentioned idea at the height of the AIDS epidemic to let's get drugs out on the market quickly. And then the companies basically just blew off the second part where they were supposed to do follow-up tests, and they just leave the drugs on, accruing enormous revenues, and nobody at FDA can quite get their act together to make them do the follow-up tests.
Right, so then these drugs can come onto the market that actually haven't really been shown to benefit human beings. Can you remind us how drugs are developed in the United States? You know, who are the actors? Where does the funding tend to come from in terms of helping us think about how they're regulated? We should grapple with who's doing it and how.
If you were to ask somebody from a drug company, they would tell you, as they often do in the commercials that they air, that the drugs are developed pretty much exclusively by drug manufacturers, and they have their scientists working far into the night selflessly to discover new products. And that does sometimes happen. I think it's important to give them their due. There is a lot of important research that does go on in drug companies. But the part that they leave out is that very often this work is either done heavily dependent on publicly funded research through the NIH, for example, the National Institutes of Health, or it might be totally funded by the National Institutes of Health. And then the way the patenting system works, the ownership of that molecule can become privately held, even if a lot or most or all of the research was done on the taxpayer's dime. And that's important because when we think about just sort of a fair-minded approach to what these drugs ought to cost, it would seem to make sense that if a drug was developed either largely or heavily or exclusively on the basis of NIH-funded research in a university, maybe it shouldn't be come to be publicly privately owned by a company that can then charge whatever they want for the drug. But that is the reality that we have now.
And in fact, Americans are subjected to the highest drug prices in the world. How are the prices of drugs determined, and who are the beneficiaries of those high prices?
Well, just this week we had the Boston Marathon, and in the book I describe the story of a person called Rosie Ruiz, whose name may be known to any long-distance runners who are listening. And she was somebody who, in 1980, decided that it would be a neat thing to do to kind of come into the Boston Marathon, which is, as people know, 26.2 miles long, but show up in the last couple of mile or two and then run across the finish line before everybody else in the women's category and say, look at me, I won the Boston Marathon. And then she got up on the pedestal and they gave her the traditional laurel in her hair and the medal that goes to the winner. And a lot of people then said, wait a minute, she doesn't look like she just ran 26 miles. But she took the medal, claimed credit, gave interviews. Turns out later she had done the same thing in New York City at that marathon, that she had gotten on the subway to the finish line and then got off one stop ahead and then said, look at me, I'm running a fast marathon. And I use that example to think about the way some drug companies behave in terms of taking advantage of publicly funded research and then showing up, in a sense, close to the finish line and saying, hey, look at me, I've got this molecule and now I own it and give me my medal. And it's really not an ideal way of pricing drugs, but unique in all the world, the U.S. has a system in which we allow the manufacturer who owns the molecule, even if they didn't do the entire discovery of it, to charge whatever in the world they want to charge for it. And that's because of a well-intentioned law that went astray, that ironically was passed in 1980, which was the same year that Rosie Ruiz claimed that she won the marathon and didn't. It was called the Bayh-Dole Act by two senators, Senator Birch Bayh and Senator Bob Dole. And they said, let's allow the fruits of publicly funded research to enter the marketplace so that you can have a university or a medical school or an academic medical center sell the results of its NIH-funded research to the highest bidder. And that way the drug companies will be able to get it out to the people. You know, the idea that you can't have a medicine get out to the people except by means of having it owned by a company that charges whatever they want for it is a dubious proposition. But that was the idea back in 1980. And so we have this situation where there is no checks and balances on what companies charge. And some of the biggest payers of our drug bills, of course, are the government, whether it's Medicare or Medicaid or the VA or the Department of Defense medical system. And they are the ones who are footing the bill along with all the rest of us in our healthcare premiums or our tax dollars. And we don't seem to be able to figure out a way, even though pretty much every other wealthy country has figured out a way of saying, let's figure out what this drug is worth and let's pay the manufacturer very handsomely if it's a good drug. Let's also pay them enough to make up for all the dead ends that they might have gone down in trying to discover a new drug. So, you know, we don't want to penalize them. We want to reward them if it's a good drug. But the system we now have alone in the world is that whatever the manufacturer wants to charge, they charge and we got to pay for it.
Jerry Avorn is my guest. He's professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. And we're talking about his book, Rethinking Medications, Truth, Power, and the Drugs You Take. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, then let's return to what you were talking about earlier, which is that because of changes in the way that drugs are regulated in the United States, a pharmaceutical company does not even need to prove that a drug actually works for it to be made available to the public, that is assuming that the public can pay for it. Can you tell us more about the process through which a drug must go to be approved? The controlled clinical trials are, of course, the gold standard for determining whether something works or does not work. How stringent is the requirement that a drug must go through controlled clinical trials before it can be approved for use?
Okay, that's an important area. And it's true that in principle, the FDA still requires companies to show that a drug works. However, almost half of all drugs that are approved are allowed to get an exception to that rule. So, you know, if you were to ask the FDA commissioner, you know, do you require the drugs be shown to work? They would say, sure, we do. And then you ask them about what about this one, what about that one? And they'll say, oh, yeah, that was an expedited pathway. That was accelerated approval. That was an orphan drug where we don't make people do the same level of, you know, randomized placebo-controlled trials. So, you know, they like to say at FDA, we still require that a drug be shown to work, but there are these exceptions. And now we're in a place where almost all half of the drugs that are approved are exceptions. But we really need to kind of go back to our roots there, because the randomized controlled trial is really one of the best inventions that we've ever come up with as a human species. We don't think of it as an invention because it doesn't have like gears and lights and buzzers and things, but it's a conceptual invention where if you take a big number of people and you randomly give them the new drug or a comparison, it can either be placebo or maybe the other drug that we always use for that condition, and then follow them for a good enough time and measure all the outcomes, it's very hard to be fooled by that, because if the only thing that's different between the two groups is who got the new drug and who didn't, and neither the doctor nor the patient nor the evaluator knows who got what, then it's a pretty bulletproof way of knowing that any differences you see in the outcomes must be because of that that drug and not due to chance or due to something else. Now, that's a wonderful idea, but again, FDA, and at the urging often of the manufacturers, is more than happy to bend the rules, in my view, more often than they ought to, and say, well, maybe you don't really need a control group, or maybe you don't really need to follow to see if the patient's better, you know, as I was saying before, just is the lab test better. And the number of drugs that are subjected to these carefully done, large, randomized controlled trials that Senator Kefauver's law required back in 1962, that number has really diminished to the point where it is no longer the uniformly applied standard. And again, the manufacturers are more than happy to have a looser standard, just like Rosie Ruiz was happy to enter the race just before the finish line, because it's much easier to get a drug approved on that basis. But it does not give us doctors the information we need when we're trying to prescribe something, nor does it give patients the information they may want to access, nor does it give payers, whether it's an insurance company or the Medicaid program or anybody, the information they need about, well, how good is this drug anyway? And so we've really begun to have loopholes that are getting bigger with every passing year.
And can some of those loopholes involve having clinical trials, but that don't reach the standard of having, say, a large enough sample size for the treatment group and the control group, or things like that, where a trial is taking place, and for your layperson looking at the numbers, it might seem reasonable and genuine, but actually it's not robust enough to give enough proof.
Exactly right. And the plight of the patient is sadly very similar to the plight of the doctor. You know, it's very hard for prescribers to know much more than is FDA approved. You know, when you consider how many hours it takes in a day to just be a primary care doctor, for example, and to just get through the day and prescribe the drugs that are out there. If you can't know whether FDA approval means this was a great large study that was very well controlled and that the outcomes were impressive, or whether the company just said, yeah, I made a lab test better, give us our approval, the approval looks the same to the doctor and to the patient, and legally to the payer, whether it's a private insurance company or a government program like Medicaid. And it's not really reasonable to expect that every doctor or patient will, quote, do their own research to go back and see what is the basis on which this drug was approved. We do a fair amount of that in my research group at Harvard. A lot of that is led by my colleague Aaron Kesselheim, and we get very smart folks to really get in the weeds and look at the patents and look at the papers and look at the grants and figure out what exactly was the basis for this approval and how does it work. But that's not something that is, you know, we shouldn't have to have everybody figure that out on their own any more than we should have everybody who eats a hamburger figure out if the animal was was not ridden with disease before it was killed, or if you open the tap, having everybody do their own water testing to make sure the water is potable. You know, this is something that societies have governments that to which we delegate the responsibility for doing that work. And as we all know, that delegation is eroding literally month by month.
In 2021, the Food and Drug Administration approved a new drug for Alzheimer's disease called Aduhelm, to much fanfare. However, the drug didn't actually work, could cause brain damage. I think brain bleeding and was prohibitively expensive. Can you tell us how it was approved by the FDA?
Yeah, and that's something I dwell on a bit because it is kind of the poster child for how to get things wrong in drug regulation. The company, which is actually based in the Boston area here, was called Biogen, and they did, you know, try. They did a large clinical trial. They spent many, many millions of dollars on it. Their drug was designed according to the hypothesis that Alzheimer's is caused by a buildup of amyloid in the brain, and if you could invent an antibody that would search out and destroy that amyloid, it might make Alzheimer's better. That's not been a super successful strategy, but there's been a lot invested in it and by NIH and by drug companies. And so they came up with this drug called Aduhelm. And as their clinical trials were being finished, and it actually was a careful clinical trial that was randomized, double-blind, controlled, and, you know, everything you'd want it to be. I think they maybe wish they hadn't done it, such a careful study. The statisticians that the company employed came back and said, you know, the data that have come in, and it's most all the data, show that we're never going to demonstrate this drug works. There is just not much of a difference between the people who got the experimental drug and the placebo. And the experimental drug, by the way, was an IV infusion that you had to take every 2 weeks for, you know, many, many months or years. And it did have the side effects that you mentioned. So they said, that's not acceptable. We really need to come up with a better way forward. We spent a lot of money developing and testing this drug. And so they had some meetings with the FDA, some of which were actually back-channel meetings that were not recorded, which is not according to the policy that FDA is supposed to adhere to. And they came up with another way of looking at the data from the same studies that they said, well, maybe it looks better if you look at it this way. And they brought the FDA brought the question to its outside advisory committee of scientists, as they often do. Less and less, by the way, every year, but they still were doing that a number of years ago more frequently. And all the advisory committee members said, this drug doesn't work. The data do not show that it's helpful. And by the way, it can cause brain bleeding and brain swelling. And you got to take it every 2 weeks intravenously, which is a burden for an older patient who's got cognitive impairment. So they said, no, it shouldn't be approved. And in a remarkable demonstration of regulatory sleaze, the head of the program at FDA in charge of approving these drugs, Dr. Janet Woodcock, said, actually, you know, we brought this drug to the advisory committee to look at if it helped patients. And yeah, you're kind of right, it doesn't help patients. But let's reconceptualize it as a drug for accelerated approval, which was never anything the accelerated approval program was designed to do, to take a drug that flunked its clinical trial and go back and look for a lab test that it made better. But sure enough, that's what Dr. Woodcock and the management at FDA did. And they said, yeah, you're right, it doesn't really improve people's brain function, but it does make a small difference in the level of amyloid in your brain. So we'll consider this an accelerated approval. We'll approve the drug. And then in part of that social contract that I mentioned earlier, we'll have the company go back and do better studies to see if it really works. The problem with that was that they gave the company 9 years to do those follow-up studies to see if it works, which really made the entire process into kind of a joke. And to make matters worse, the company initially said, after it was approved in this bizarre way, we're going to charge $56,000 a year per person for that drug as its list price because we can. And FDA, as if it couldn't make anything worse, made everything worse by saying, oh, okay, and your approval is for everybody with Alzheimer's, not just the mild to moderate people that were in your clinical trial, which makes no sense clinically because, you know, some people with severe Alzheimer's, even if the drug worked, and it didn't, are not going to benefit from the drug if they've already had so much brain damage, if you believe about the amyloid story. It's not going to help them anyway. So FDA just made a series of really dumb decisions. And somebody calculated that if it was used as widely as the FDA allowed, and if they stuck with the list price of $56,000, the country would spend as much on this one drug that didn't work as it did on the entire budget for NASA. So this is a big budget hit. And the The Medicare program had to jack up the premiums for everybody involved in their drug benefit, because after all, insurance is about spreading the risk across the whole population. So even people who were not going to get the drug had their premiums jacked up to pay for it in anticipation. It was probably a low point. In fact, my colleague Kesselheim was on the advisory committee, and he and two other experts resigned from the committee saying, why are we even meeting if you're going to undo our decisions and go against your own scientific people within the agency? And then we wrote an op-ed in the Times, Kesselheim and I, saying something like, this is the worst decision in FDA's history. That's an example of how low we can go. And one would hope that we would have learned a lesson and get better, but I'm not sure we've learned that lesson yet.
Well, listeners might want to know why. Why do you think the FDA would have done that? Why would they have ignored all the evidence and approved it anyway? The massive economic ramifications aside, you know, there was not evidence that it worked.
Well, the FDA is under a ton of political pressure from the drug industry. And under both Republican and Democrat administrations, it has knuckled under to that political pressure way more often recently than it used to. And they often will pay attention to that pressure more than to the science. And after all, the pharmaceutical industry has got the biggest lobbying presence in Washington of any industry groups. And so they are very able to phone their friendly local congressperson or even lean on the administration and say, you know, you guys are being too tough on our drugs and you're denying needed products from the American people. And FDA more and more has been listening to that pressure more than saying, no, we're going to stand up for the science.
Jerry Avorn is my guest. I'm speaking with him about his book, Rethinking Medications, Truth, Power, and the Drugs You Take. He's professor of medicine at Harvard. And I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, what about the side effects from drugs that are approved and are used by the public? How effectively are they tracked by the FDA if it turns out that there are side effects that weren't flagged, or at least flagged effectively, during the approval process?
Well, that's one of the parts of the approval process that is actually getting better and is much better than it was in the early 2000s. And again, I think we improved as a country by virtue of a tragedy. We don't seem to be able to sort of sit down and say, let's make rational policy that's going to help everybody. We wait for some disaster to happen and then say, holy cow, where did that come from? As we did with thalidomide, as we did with sulfanilamide. And the drug safety disaster that actually put us in a better place once people understood what it meant was a drug for pain and arthritis that Merck was marketing very heavily in the early 2000s called Vioxx. And many listeners will have heard of it. Many of them may have taken it. It was the best-selling drug in the world for a while in its heyday in the early 2000s. And many of us were concerned that the pharmacology of Vioxx was such that it could raise the risk of heart disease. And we actually were doing a study, and we couldn't get anyone in my group at Harvard, and we couldn't get anyone to fund it except for Merck. And I said to Merck, you know, you got to let us do the study we want, and we're going to publish what we find. And you've got kind of a moral responsibility as the people who are purveying this drug to really make sure you understand about its side effects. And there was a very good head of epidemiology at Merck who I began doing this research with the support of, named Harry Guess, who unfortunately developed very severe cancer and died early in our study. And then the stewardship of our study was taken over by people who were maybe not as enlightened as Dr. Guess was. And to make a long story short, and all the gory details are in one of the chapters, we did a study exactly as we told Merck we were going to do it, looking at tens of thousands of people and looking at their use of Vioxx on their use of other drugs and whether or not they had heart attacks. And sure enough, we found that people who were having heart attacks were more likely to have been Vioxx users. And that was very worrisome. And upon getting the news of the study that they had funded, Merck said, no, you did it wrong. This is bad science. You're going to become a laughingstock. Don't publish it. We did, of course. And they tried to suppress some of the authors on the study, which is a grisly story of its own. But the point is it was published in the main cardiology journal, and other groups around the country were doing similar research that were pointing to the same thing. And Merck stonewalled everybody. They said, no, you all have it wrong. This drug doesn't cause heart disease. And that went fine. They were selling for them. They were selling about $2.5 billion a year of drug during those years. And then another study came out that was a randomized controlled trial against placebo, and they had to stop the study prematurely because the drug turned out to be doubling and tripling the rate of heart attacks and strokes. And so where that left the country was there were hearings held in Washington, and actually Senator Grassley was one of the more effective, outspoken people on this issue. And he said to FDA, in effect, how the hell did you have this drug on the market for 5 years, taken by 20 million Americans, and you kept saying it didn't cause a problem, and it turns out that it doubles or triples or more the risk of heart attacks and stroke? What's going on? And he asked the same question of FDA. And FDA needed to say, actually, yeah, we're using this old-fashioned system where if somebody out there thinks they saw a drug side effect, they fill out a form and they fax it into us, and we look at the forms and we try to see if there's a signal there, which is, you know, an incredibly inefficient, primitive, and unreliable way of doing it. But that was their way. And although many of us had been using very, very large data sets of tens of millions of people for whom we would screen all their drug use, as we did in my research, and still do, in my research group at Harvard and at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, which is one of its teaching hospitals, and look at who took what drug, what complications did they suffer, is there a link? And that can be done very powerfully, very efficiently, very quickly. And the FDA kept saying, no, we're not into that. And Vioxx forced Congress to force the FDA to set up a program where they would do what many groups like ours had been doing for years, but to make it part of the nation's safety surveillance system. And so the happy ending, in a sense, is that we are now doing that routinely, and we are not at risk of having another Vioxx come along. And so even though we've gotten, I think, less effective at FDA in the measuring of efficacy side, I think we've gotten much better as a nation in being able to pick up side effects before you have 20 million people taking a drug over 5 years.
I'd like to turn to another class of drugs which have followed quite a different trajectory than the one you've been describing of the FDA being overly lenient about the safety or the efficacy of drugs, and that is psychedelic drugs, drugs like psilocybin and MDMA, which are now being studied for the treatment of things like PTSD for veterans after decades of criminalization. Why were those drugs treated so differently than the ones that you've been describing?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Sasha. And it comes back to the so-called war on drugs that was really put into overdrive by President Nixon back in the 70s. And I think he was seeing that as kind of a political tool for, you know, beating up on the classes of people that he was not very fond of. You know, much as we're seeing the current war against DEI being used to, you know, or the allegations of anti-Semitism, which are often not even correct, being used to beat up on people that the government wants to beat up on. And so Nixon declared during his presidency all of these substances to be illegal. And when I was a medical student back in the early 70s, I had heard about a group in Maryland at a state hospital that was doing research on giving LSD to patients who were dying of cancer. And they were trying to see whether they could help people sort of transition from life by giving them a different understanding of what life and death and human existence are. And, you know, as a child of the 60s, that really appealed to me. So I spent a month down there in Maryland studying with that team. And as I describe in the book, there's all these amazing experiences that people were having. These were regular, you know, kind of off the street, working class people with no particular religious convictions and certainly no history of studying Buddhism. And they were having these mystical experiences that sounded like something out of the most amazing literature of transcendent religious traditions over the millennia. And that was pretty cool. And I even thought about maybe that's what I would want to do when I finished medical school and became a doctor. And then within a year of my time down there and all the amazing experiences that I had and wrote about, that drug and that process were declared to be impermissible even for scientific research. And so we have had 40 years about in which the government said, not only will we arrest you if you're in possession of some of these substances, but we're not even going to let doctors study this in a controlled research environment. And so it put on hold an enormous and very promising field of research, because as you said, there may turn out, and I think in 10 years, if all goes well, we'll look back and say, how in the world did we allow these drugs to be put in a deep freeze for 40 years? Enormous promise for things like post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, many, many other kinds of mental illness. And I had the chance just in the last couple of years to begin to hang out with people in the Boston area who were trying to get studies done of MDMA or ecstasy for treating PTSD. And the studies were going very well. I mean, they seemed very promising. There are a lot of interesting questions about how do you do a randomized placebo-controlled trial of something that, you know, can give you ecstatic visions. You know, people kind of pick up on, did I get the placebo or not? But led by a wonderful guy named Rick Doblin, who has been really at the forefront of psychedelic research for decades, there were some very promising studies going on. Unfortunately, they were being done all around the country and the world by people who are not always used to doing clinical trials for, you know, as are done often for drug companies, where there's a protocol and everybody knows how to follow the rules and it's kind of cut and dried. This was a much more different approach that was taken. And by the time all the data came in, yes, it was looking very promising. However, there were some idiosyncrasies in the way the data was being collected and handled. And, you know, if you're the FDA, you really can't tolerate having those kinds of oddities in the data that, you know, you're going to use to approve a drug, especially a controversial drug class like the psychedelics. And FDA was kind of scared politically that they would get into trouble if somebody came along and raised questions about whether or not these drugs really worked. And then FDA would be blamed for any problem. So at the end of the day, just a year ago, the advisory committee that looked at the data said, gee, you know, this is just a little too sketchy. We're not sure we are okay with this drug. It shouldn't be approved. And the FDA was more than happy to say, no, 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 you can't use this drug legally. And sadly, it set this very promising field back a bunch of years. I bet that if we are lucky enough to be able to talk to one another in 5 or 10 years, the studies will have been done and they will have passed muster at FDA, but they're pretty much having to go back to square one now and rethink the whole design of the study and how do you do a placebo-controlled trial. So in a very dramatic and in the end a very sad way, the official FDA evaluation of these drugs has kind of at the moment hit a dead end. And while I'm sure there will be other studies coming forward that will have better results, we're not there yet and they remain illegal for clinical use.
Sure, and as you're illustrating, have been illustrating through the course of the hour, obviously all these decisions around medicine are political and also connected to profit-making. And I wanted to ask you about the times that we now are living in, because you've been describing the compromised nature of the FDA through much of the 20th century into the 21st. But obviously, with the Trump administration, the appointing of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as the head of the Department of Health and Human Services, there is a profound change going on. I mean, you were mentioning studies to do with PTSD in the VA, which is the only part of the country that actually has socialized medicine just for veterans, you know, big cuts to the VA, slashing of the National Institutes of Health, research funding universities. How do you imagine the way that drugs have been approved is going to be transformed by this moment? And also the question about how this is playing out with the pharmaceuticals industry, because clearly they have benefited from the public largesse of research in universities and in the government, which now has been undercut.
Exactly. And these are, I got to say, as somebody who's been worrying about these issues since the early 1970s in medicine, these are the scariest times that I've ever lived through. The devastation that is occurring on a day-by-day basis in medical research is absolutely awful. Sitting here at Harvard, where we have been subjected to threats of $9 billion of funding cuts and all sorts of other just draconian measures, people who've been working on issues that ought to be completely politically neutral, like, you know, tuberculosis, cancer, psychosis, all these are not diseases that have a political dimension, or at least in terms of treatments for them. And yet the administration has, in a very broad-based way, taken a baseball bat to the funding of a lot of labs, many of which are even basic science research. And people I know have had their entire life's work ended in a week because there was a stop work order coming from NIH, not even about the content of their work, but because the administration wants to beat up on Harvard. The other university I relate to is where I was in college, Columbia, and a similar thing was done there. And the idea that you can, and ironically, at both Columbia and Harvard, the medical school and the academic medical centers where all this NIH research is going on is not even on the same campus. It's miles away, and whatever was going on the campuses that, of course, should have nothing to do with funding science research, but even that was removed geographically and organizationally from the places that are getting the crap kicked out of them at the moment. So it is very scary that the seed research that is going to lead to the drugs of tomorrow is being basically smothered in its crib. And a lot of people who don't follow this, you know, on a week-by-week basis won't notice the downfall of this, you know, for several years, because the drug companies, you know, will not have all that very good, risky, expensive basic research that the NIH has been funding in universities. You know, we're going to lose years of that work, and some of it is never going to come back as strong as it could have if it had been allowed to just progress. But that will not be evident to a lot of people on, you know, in the normal world until it's too late. So that part is terrifying. And on the closer to the delivery side, the amount of disinformation about vaccines that has proliferated. I mean, how, if you asked me a year ago, are we going to have a kind of completely ignorant anti-vaxxer running the entire Department of Health and Human Services, I would have said that's a lefty paranoid fantasy. Don't worry about that. That'll never happen. And of course, it has happened. And we've seen immediately the consequences of that. Vaccination rates, which were already lower than they should be, are remaining so low that we're now having outbreaks of the measles in this country. Measles used to be a controlled disease. We've got a great, safe, and effective vaccine to prevent it that people are not taking because RFK Jr. and his cohorts have been saying it causes autism, it causes cancer, it doesn't work. Stuff that is absolutely untrue. But all you got to do is convince enough percent of the population and you begin to see exactly what we expected we would see, which is the recurrence of a totally preventable disease like measles. It's very scary times.
Well, lastly, let me end by asking you, you were talking earlier about how doctors and patients really only get the information that they have about medicines, which are at the center, for better or for worse, of our medical system. They get that information from the pharmaceuticals companies. And as you've just said, there's mass disinformation also coming from the U.S. government. Is there any place where people can go to find really unbiased, unfettered information not shaped by commercial interests or by reactionary right-wing paranoia in the public interest? Does such a thing exist? Could it exist? Does it exist elsewhere that we could, you know, access across borders?
That's a great question, Sasha. And it's also a nice one to end on because, yes, there is a sort of happy ending to what the public can do. In the back of the book, there are many, many pages of what can patients and doctors, for that matter, do to get information that is of better reliability and accuracy than, let's say, the garbage commercials you see on the news every night on television, which, as you know, no other country allows direct-to-consumer ads of prescription drugs, but we do. So I've collected all the sites I've come across in the last 40 years that I think are reliable. And not that every patient ought to sort of figure out what drugs they need on their own, but to have a conversation with a doctor. And we've got another group that I set up that's a nonprofit that educates doctors about drugs independent of any noise coming from their manufacturers. I named it ALOSA, A-L-O-S-A, because it's the genus of fish that swim upstream, like herring, and we're doing a lot of swimming upstream. So at the back of the book, there are some websites and some resources and some services that one can get at either no or minimal cost to at least be able to understand what's going on. I do not encourage people to just kind of Google the name of their drug and on the internet and see what comes up, because a lot of that is garbage. But if you go to some of the vetted sites that I'm proposing, you can get a more rounded understanding of what's the evidence and then engage in a conversation with the prescriber, whether it's a doctor or a nurse practitioner. And if you're going to be asked to put a chemical in your body, you get to spend a few minutes talking to whoever's prescribing it about, is there a better alternative? Is this affordable? How do we know it works? And any doctor that doesn't have time to do that means that you should probably find another doctor if you can. So there are resources available so that people don't need to finish reading the book and just have a sense of despair and all is lost. There are things that consumers and even physicians and nurses can do to get up to speed on these complicated issues.
And at againstthegrain.org, you can find some of those websites. Jerry Avorn, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure talking with you, Sasha. Thank you for having me.
Jerry Avorn is professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He's an internist and spent many years as a primary care doctor, author of Rethinking Medications, Truth, Power, and the Drugs You Take, which is published by Simon & Schuster. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.